Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James, who may or may not be listening to Metallica right now.
He's not.
Before we get started, be sure to check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. We've had a pretty good 2015 so far as movie selections. City Lights, Inherent Vice, Eyes Wide Shut, Sunset Boulevard, and Top Gun somehow worked its way in there. Check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. Follow us on Twitter, at themacguffinmen. Earlier this week, we put out a podcast on Sunset Boulevard, which is our last podcast. I did a conversation with Luke of Ivory Hours about music in general and his songwriting process, so that was fun. I wrote something, so that's on the website, so you can check that out. And follow us on Twitter to keep up to date with all of the things that we are talking about. And to continue on with our good movie list, we're not talking about just one today. We got to pack in two, so we'll just get right to it.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, Metallica Superfan 69. What are we talking about today?
It's the New York bank robbery doubleheader.
Yeah.
Dog Day Afternoon and Inside Man.
Yeah.
Yeah. This was your idea, right? To make this a two-hander?
The rumors are true. This was my idea. I came up with it, woke up in the middle of the night with an epiphany, wrote it, scrawled it on the notepad that I keep next to my bed for such genius moments.
Do you want to explain your idea, your unifying theory beyond New York bank robberies, or do you want to get into it first? Or
I feel like it's sort of, I mean, the easy things are like, I can point out the easy things. Multiple Sidney Lumet movies are mentioned in Inside Man.
Right.
One of them being Dog Day Afternoon. A cast member from Dog Day Afternoon is in Inside Man.
Two of them, I think.
Two? I only know Miriam, the hostage in Inside Man. Who's the other?
The pizza delivery person.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which is, I think, even better because it's a smaller part.
That is really great. I didn't know that. I didn't look into the IMDb trivia for this one. But anyway, and you know, they're both New York bank robbery movies, but and Sidney Lumet and Spike Lee are both generally associated with New York. But I just think there's a lot of thematic similarities, but also not so much that it would become repetitive, you know? I think they're both kind of about the same thing, but also somehow totally different. And I find that really interesting.
Okay. And you know? I should say Spike Lee has, you know, been on the record saying that he thinks Dog Day Afternoon is a fantastic movie. Obviously, the fact that he mentions it in it and hires some people to play the same parts, it's very clearly an influence on him to the point that, I mean, Inside Man is far from just a remake of Dog Day Afternoon. Like they do have a lot of those things in common that you listed. And yeah, on the surface, they're pretty similar, but they're certainly very different movies.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I imagine part of your interest in comparing the two is probably comparing filmmaking of that time and how it affects each one.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, let's just start with Dog Day Afternoon. I feel like it'll come out naturally, right?
Sure.
That sort of makes sense. Dog Day Afternoon,
Sidney Lumet, as we mentioned.
Sidney Lumet, the very underrated Sidney Lumet, even though everybody kind of, like, everybody that knows who he is knows he's good, but in general, I think underrated. And I mean, he made this and Network back to back, I think, which is a pretty impressive, impressive two movie run. Dog Day Afternoon is awesome. This movie's so good. Like it's such a wonderful example of the slow burn movie, I suppose is what you could call it. Like, because I mean, we talked about this a bit off the podcast, but made me want to talk about this movie was seeing it again for the first time in a decade. It was playing in Cineplex theaters recently. And I don't know. It's pretty rare that I sort of fall into a movie as hard as I fell into Dog Day Afternoon when I was watching it in the cinema. I feel like the whole movie is about being backed into a corner, and its pace is very measured. Like when I went to hang out with some friends immediately after I saw the movie, I was like, oh, I just saw Dog Day Afternoon. And they're like, oh, it's that slow movie, right? And which is, yes, true. But it just slowly pushes you further and further into Sonny's shoes and further into feeling trapped. And when he starts to feel resigned to his situation, it's so painful to watch. It's really, I don't know, it's really bizarre how affected by this movie I was. Yeah,
my thing about this movie becoming increasingly claustrophobic, and you know, as you said, a slow burn movie and kind of getting slowly backed into the corner, is that the police presence seems to show up pretty quickly and doesn't really intensify. And I just mean from his perspective, there's not a lot, I mean, police force-wise, that is getting any stricter on him. You know what I mean? Like, it's not as though they're barricading in on him. I mean, there's that one point where he thinks they're coming in the back door, but, you know, hours and hours of this movie pass without the police really trying to do anything. And I think that that feeling of, you know, increased tension, it comes from all the character stuff that we learn in this movie. Like, it's things, I agree, things certainly are progressing, and I think it you know, things do, the feeling does get more tense, and I think a lot of that is achieved through good filmmaking and through the script being more about personal life than about you know, oh, they just threw a flashbang in, or, you know, they found out our guns are fake, or, you know, it's not as though the police are really getting any closer to solving this, it seems. It just, all the other things about the passage of time and about the other people he communicates with in the next little bit of this movie is what makes this progress.
Yeah, for sure. Like, the only real progression we see really comes in the last probably 20 to 30 minutes of the movie, when the FBI kind of takes over for the more seeming more like a normal human being cop that we get for most of the movie. I don't recall his name. But Sonny's initial point of contact and point of contact for most of the movie. And eventually where to the point where the FBI, right after Sonny's talked to his mom, said goodbye to his mom, just tells him, you've got 10 minutes and we're coming for you, you know, which is the most, outside of the final act of violence, is kind of the most aggressive thing any police or any law enforcement enacts, right?
Yeah that's what I mean.
Exactly, like this movie is more about us slowly learning what has led Sonny to the bank more than what is happening within the bank to sort of have him backed into the corner. And that's the amazing thing about this movie is, yeah, he is getting more and more he's basically figuring out more and more throughout the film, in the actual situation that he's in the bank currently, that his chances are diminishing and gone. But throughout the movie, we do slowly learn all of these character things that led him to the bank in the first place, which is really interesting.
Yeah, there does seem a sense of inevitable doom. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anyone feels it more than Sal, who very quickly into this movie gets very, very nervous and does not seem very confident about the way things are going to go.
Yeah, and I love that they're kind of I forgot how bumbling Sonny was in this movie and how well, at least in moments, Pacino plays it. Like, when they first start the bank robbery, the way he's fiddling with the flower box that has his gun in it, like, it's not like a clean, he's not, you know, Robert De Niro in Heat cleanly making his assault rifle known to the people in the bank.
Oh, like the ribbon stuck on the sight for a second. And it's just him getting it out of the box is not a very smooth operation.
Yeah, and him burning the register for whatever reason is what ends up trapping them. And I don't know. It's just, he's just kind of a bumbling fool a lot in the movie. And I don't think that's the type of character I'd seen Pacino play. And it's interesting to see him. It's interesting to see Michael Corleone like this, you know?
Yeah, no, he's definitely not completely inept, but he's very underprepared.
And, yes, yeah.
It's, yeah, it is interesting to watch that. And it's, I mean, bank heist movies, we see it very well in Inside Man. You really want to be in control of everyone, yeah. And you want to appear very, very confident and capable. And there are a lot of good laughs in the first hour of this movie, mostly related to either how poorly it's thought out or how poor their decision making is at this point, or
a bank robber quitting about 5 minutes into the job.
Yeah, Stevie, no less. Stevie. Inside Man joke.
Yeah.
but just how he's not the bank robbing type, you know, once everyone starts talking about going to the washroom and just he's not that type. And as we learn throughout this movie, he doesn't really seem to be willing to hurt anybody. He doesn't want to be the person who is going to hurt someone. He very openly states, I'm Catholic, I don't want to hurt anybody. Mm-hmm. You know, he has this, you know, plan to rob this bank, but they never really sell themselves very as bank robbers, either in their ruthlessness or in their execution.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you can really see it in the way that he's just hanging out with the hostages, and the hostages are just having fun, and like they're playing with weapons with their bank robber. And I forget her name in this movie, but Miriam in Inside Man is just having a ball. Like, this for a good portion of this movie, the hostages are just straight up having fun, and it's really interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, she wants to go back in when she kind of looks like she has a chance when she's at the front door to leave. And
oh, that's
like
that's Irish Jenna Elfman. Let's do it.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Yeah. But I mean, she's never looking for a way to break. You know, it's they're all having fun.
Yeah, and if even that woman, there's a moment. When they're putting when they're going to release the security guard, where the cops are like, "Oh, we need one hostage," and Sonny's like, "Well, him, right?" And then that same woman's like, "Right, like of course he's having an asthma attack."
Yeah. Oh, that part is so funny to me. Yeah. Like, just conferring with your hostages of which one should be sent out. And yes, obviously the one who might be dying of asthma right this very second. Yeah.
I'm happy to know that I have a leg up on my other hostages and getting released first with my with my asthma.
Exactly. Oh. And Stevie wanting to take the car when he leaves.
Oh, yeah.
Not considering how everyone else will get away or get home or anything like
take
that.
The subway.
Yeah. Very, very good.
Yeah.
You mentioned Sidney Lumet's good film run.
Yeah.
And we've mentioned Sal. So I think if we're going to be talking about good film runs.
Oh, yeah. We got to mention John Cazale.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine we talked about him a fair bit in the Godfather podcast.
I think so. I'm sure we did. We ran through the things that we have to say where he was in what, 5 movies, and all of them were nominated for Best Picture.
Yeah.
And not just like 5, you know, Julie and Julia type Best Picture nominees, but like he was in 5 really good movies.
Yeah, 5 very good movies, and had, you know, standout performances in movies with Brando and De Niro and Pacino and Streep and Walken, and you know, just very, very, very talented actors and actresses.
Yeah, exactly. He is a very good actor, and I think the only reason he's in this movie, I don't have any facts to back this up, I think the only reason he's in this movie is because him and Pacino were so close, like they were best friends, and it's such a small role. Like this role is kind of beneath John Cazale, especially since this is coming out a year after Godfather 2, which is, I mean, as Fredo in Godfather 2, that's Cazale's biggest role in anything, and certainly his most famous role. So yeah, I do think he's there more because Pacino is the star, and he probably thought the movie was going to be good, and he's like, well, I'll hang out with Pacino for a month, why not? You know, he's my boy.
Yeah, that's my understanding, to the point that we haven't mentioned this movie is based on a true story. The Sal character that he's based on was 19 years old.
And, oh, really?
Yeah, he was, I think, 38 or something for this movie. And it was just Pacino, you know, acting partner. And really Pacino wanted to work with him.
Yeah, Pacino is younger than Cazale, right? By a few years? Am I right in thinking that? It doesn't
maybe.
Matter. It doesn't I'm not matter. Sure. I can't. I don't know what I'm trying to get to the bottom of here. okay. But yeah, because that was really good in this movie, and I know it is. It's very, very much a supporting part. There's probably like a, well, I mean, there's a kind of a 15-minute stretch of this movie where everybody but Sonny disappears, but well, Sonny and Leon, but Cazal really does the most with probably less than 20 lines. Like I really love that scene where Sonny asks Sal, where do you want to go? What country do you want to visit? He says Wyoming, and Sonny tells Sal that Wyoming's not a country. And the look on John Cazal's face is just like the look of somebody that has known his whole life that he's dumb and he's just learning it again. And it's just such a defeated look. And I think that moment's really great. Like it's interesting partially in this movie to watch Sonny slowly break and to see how quickly Sal is kind of already there, you know?
Yeah, no, that's, it seems like he's, yeah, at that point when this movie starts and you just like, he plays vulnerable and broken so incredibly well that just watching him do that. Did you know that that Wyoming line was improvised?
I had no idea.
Yeah.
That's great.
The John Cazal original.
Oh, right? That's great. I had no idea.
Yeah, so did you read anything about the improvised nature of this movie?
I will say I have not had a lot of time to research these movies outside of watching them.
Okay.
I read Sidney Lumet's book, though, so, but he didn't talk a lot about improv in it.
Okay, so I guess this movie was written by Frank Pearson, mm-hmm. and, you know, this is a time when Pacino is, you know, this is post-Godfather. People know that Pacino's a very talented actor by this point.
Pacino in the 70s is one of the consensus great actors, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And so just to contextualize it. So they, you know, let actors do a lot of kind of improv on this, and they would, you know, rehearse it a few times and then take some of the things that they improvised and then try to work that into kind of another, you know, more of a script, you know, not word for word again, but still kind of keep that idea with it. And then we'd just run it through a few times. And then once all the actors and directors agreed on a dialogue that they're really happy with, they went back to the script, changed it, and made that the official screenplay. Oh. So, like, they really, like, they did improv. It's not all ad-libbed, you know, as the cameras are rolling. But I guess he just gave them a lot of time to do these performances without the camera rolling, really figure out kind of organically how these actors would want to do it, change that, and then make that, like, the go-to script. So, it just shows a lot of faith in actors, I would think, like,
yeah,
to,
for sure,
to let them do this.
And like I mentioned, I read Sidney Lumet's book, Making Movies, and it's a really fascinating book and really, really interesting if you like Sidney Lumet or if you just like the process of Hollywood films being made. He does seem to be a huge fan of rehearsals in general. He's done.
And he comes from stage, too.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. And so he's in his book, like the big takeaway is that he feels like the rehearsal period is the most important part of getting or shooting a movie and to sort of listen to your actors is a big thing that he does. And he's all about making sure everybody is comfortable once they get on set. So he tries to learn as much as possible beforehand about the way the actor likes to work. With Pacino, he already knew how he worked because they had done Serpico together. But he likes to get to know the people and how they like their process to work. And he likes to always treat it with the utmost respect. And I think by letting these actors have this control in the rehearsal process, which I doubt is a Dog Day Afternoon exclusive in Lumet's filmography, I think he sort of lets them or encourages them to take more ownership of the picture. And I find that that's an interesting strategy. And yeah, it's cool.
And led to some good performances, obviously.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, and it, other than the Wyoming line, the back and forth between Pacino and his last name's Durning, but the first point of contact you're talking about, the police mm-hmm. negotiator, they're kind of really aggressive back and forth after those shots are fired at the back door.
Yeah.
That's, I think, is one of the like really heavily changed parts that was a result of this process we were discussing. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's a really important movie, it would seem to me, like to do that kind of stuff with your actors, because as we said, like it is a bank robbery movie, but it's a very character-driven one, very performance-driven one, and it's just kind of it feels like a weird word because it is a very tight claustrophobic movie, but it's also like it there is room to breathe here. Like, it is kind of spacious. We have only a few sets, but you know, we have a camera that'll move a little bit, and we have, you know, space between lines, and we have these very naturalistic performances that, like, just strike me as very, very naturalistic, mm-hmm. you know, execution of the script.
Yeah, and it is, it's one of those movies where, you know, you hear about this every once in a while where the director wants the whole room to be lit, like the lit like that room would actually be lit. Like, there was a big feeling of naturalism throughout the production of Dog Day Afternoon in the lighting and everything. Like, they tried to restrict the lights to actually in the bank to actually being where the fluorescence would be in the design of that hypothetical building.
Yeah.
And if they just needed more light for something, they'd just beef up the light, but always from that position. And that's always something I enjoy. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess you, no, I'm familiar with Lumet, especially because of you know, the reading you've done.
it's a brisk read. I'm not. It wasn't a 600 page. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Okay. But that seems to be. I mean, that naturalistic approach is something that is throughout his career, right?
Oh yeah, definitely.
And would you agree with the assessment? He's not much of kind of an auteur filmmaker, but just makes a movie that suits the story. Or do you find a lot of things show up?
I think you're more right than wrong. I feel like that is like profession, just sort of being a professional, you know, craftsman that serves your story. I think that is should be considered a type of auteurship, but by the classical definition of the term, no, not really. And he talks about it a lot in the book, where he just says pretty much every decision he makes has to serve the story in some way. And the way he seems to treat filmmaking is a very professional way. Like, he tries to avoid working long hours. And even though, like, his description of lunch is so funny, because apparently he fought in World War II, and he's just able to nap on command because of this. So, like, for lunch break, he'll break up his hours by when he comes to his trailer, he'll have 5 minutes to basically eat slices of ham and, like, some lettuce, and not a sandwich, but, like, all the pieces of a sandwich. He'll roll them up and eat them, and then nap for 55 minutes. And that's how he spends his lunch. And I just thought that was so funny and old timey and wonderful. That's and fantastic. I think it's a really, emblematic of how he makes films in general, because when picking the set for the bank, again, he wanted them to be able to go from the bank to the street. So they found a warehouse with a lower floor that they could rent out and design as this bank on the actual street that they could shoot on. And the reason he wanted to do that was to save time, because he thinks that if you can save four location moves in a shoot, you can save 4 days, and you can spend those 4 days focusing on something else, and something that actually helps the picture instead of just the crew tearing down and building up, you know. And that type of thing, yes, absolutely correct. He's not the traditional type of auteur, and is very dedicated to always serving the story.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear you talk about him like that, because I did see a lot of stuff about how he's known for his very quick working style and submitting a final cut under schedule, which is not very common. And then you hear him work, you know, these, as you said, these, you know, not crazy long days. He just has a very, like, efficient, very structured way of making movies that seems to be effective.
Quite frankly, it's the same thing people make fun of Clint Eastwood for, you know, like, you know, one of the things to talk about Clint Eastwood's worst movies is to say, oh, he just wanted to rap so he could get to the golf course, you know, like, that's just a thing that people say, joke about when they talk about maybe not liking American Sniper, you know. And that's, Sidney Lumet did the same thing. He just sort of had a better batting average. Now, I mean, it's not to say his filmography doesn't have some stinkers. That just sort of comes with the territory, partially the speed with which he worked, and the desire to continue working all the time, and just in general, he chose a lot of varied subjects, and eventually you're going to lose that battle, you know? So,
Yeah, no, it is. Like, I mean, that's one of the things I wanted to talk about when I said he kind of just makes the movie that fits the story.
Yeah.
He does have a career with a lot of different kinds of movies in them.
Yeah.
And still can make them good sometimes.
Yeah, well, and like the thing with his career, I think he's most remembered for Serpico and Dog Day Afternoon. I think those are the two like Sidney Lumet movies. But Murder on the Orient Express was a big deal at the time and is still, you know, remembered to a kind of person, to a certain kind of person. Like there was a 30 Rock episode built around it even. Network is his most famous movie, I think. Nobody remembers that he's actually the director of that movie because Paddy Chayefsky, I mean, it said Paddy Chayefsky's Network on the title card, you know? So it's just sort of, it's that sort of, I don't know, chameleon-like aspect to his career that kind of has made him underrated, right?
Yeah.
Because you need more than one thing to point to back up your argument. Oh, two crime movies with Pacino. He's the crime movie with Pacino. Guy,
you know? Yeah. Yeah, it's, I mean, just going back to the efficiency when he makes these movies, it shows up in the story. Like, there's just very little extra stuff. I know that in filmmaking and, you know, making everything on screen should have a purpose. So maybe that's not so unusual, but just the, you know, how little action there is. The fact that these cops don't really have a backstory, you know, and I don't mean that as this is such a one dimensional movie, but this is a movie about Sonny, and that the fact that there's no, you know, fight with your sergeant and, you know, or your tough life at home. Like it just was very focused. I just found it a very efficient movie, even though, as I said, like there is space to breathe and everything. It seems very focused on what it wants to achieve and does so successfully.
Yeah, for sure. And just speaking with the way he uses the camera, Lumet, it's a lot of what we talked about with Billy Wilder last week with Sunset Boulevard. Really picks his spots and is never wrong. You know, like when you see a dolly move in a Sidney Lumet movie, like, you know, there's a reason for it and it's pretty easy to see. And it's always an interesting idea, you know? And yeah, and I think that that's commendable as well, you know? And he also knows when to not move the camera, like when Al Pacino's talking on the phone for 15 minutes.
Yeah, which is a scene that it doesn't hijack the movie. It's certainly a lot different than what we have. Like, even though there's just a lot of dialogue and there is, you know, as I said, not a ton of action, that scene really is a little bit of the movie onto itself. Or is that just my interpretation?
No, I think you are right. I think that scene is wonderful. I think it's so good. And I think it's so important for the movie because it's kind of the only, it's where we get a lot of, you know, Sonny not being a good person, you know? He's abusive, and we don't really have a lot of that. Like, he's a bank robber, but he's the lovable bank robber. And he kind of loses some of his lovability, if you will, you know, just because of the argument he has with Leon and the way he talks to his wife as well. Well, his female wife. So, yeah, it's a really interesting scene.
Yeah, but how far do you take the idea of him as the good bank robber? I mean,
not far. I think like part of it, like he just wants that money and get out, you know?
Yeah, but we do kind of get the like the folk hero thing. I mean, not a ton of it, but I mean, we have him throwing the money to the crowd. We have people cheering for him.
Mm-hmm. The infamous Attica scene where he's basically he's saying the cops, if the cameras weren't here, the cops would shoot me. Attica, Attica, Attica.
Yeah. And I just, to bring it to that point, I think a lot of people see the value, the artistic value and kind of the long lasting value of this movie is its anti-establishment tone.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know your opinion on how much that's deserved. And I mean, more specifically, just him as kind of a folk hero, as kind of a Robin Hood character.
It's not It's not the part of the movie I spend the most time thinking about. I will say that.
It doesn't seem to be the part of the movie you spend a lot of time thinking about.
I would agree entirely. I think it's sort of, that's part of the movie that is really just, well, and I mean, one of the many parts of the movie, I suppose, that is just because of chance. And Sonny finds himself in this situation. And I feel like the first time, you know, we hear that the crowd is very positive, or he hears that the crowd is very pro Sonny, or at least partially pro Sonny, he pretty much immediately starts to play up to it. And but there is an element of that stuff that I find interesting, like playing into the idea of the outcast. He mentions, I'm an outcast, I have been my whole fucking life, or whatever, late in the film. Playing into that is his television interview, I find interesting, because the interviewer on television asks him, why doesn't he just get a normal job? And he's like, well, do you know how much a bank teller makes? The interesting part about that is, generally when somebody doesn't understand somebody's actions, it's because they can't see them through, say, Sonny, in this situation, Sonny's perspective. They can't see things outside of their own brain, right? They can't see things outside of their own prejudices. And I think those things are kind of tied into each other, and it kind of augments the general feeling of being left out. But I don't think it's the most important aspect of that. You know what I mean?
No, yeah, I know what you mean. And as I said, it's something that the movie doesn't spend a ton of time focusing on. But I think a lot of critical appreciation of this movie is, you know, yeah, a lot of 70s cinema, a lot of this kind of 70s cinema especially, mm-hmm. is that this was, you know, these filmmakers making movies for people, you know, the kind of the downtrodden, kind of the unheard masses, things like that. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the movie does play this with this idea a bit when we have, you know, him very famously chanting Attica, which was a very famous prison riot that took place the year that the sexual robbery took place earlier in the year. And, you know, was this prison riot about prisoners' rights? And generally a lot of people took up with it because it just spoke to a lot of people's general dissatisfaction with police and government mm-hmm. and together. So I just didn't know what you thought of this idea of him actually being a good figurehead for that kind of movement, because it seems like his, you know, when he hears about it, he plays it up, but it's certainly not his goal. No. You know, he has a very selfish goal, you know, to get money. And he would have done this without ever making a statement about, you know, any of these groups that aren't being fully or that are being oppressed at this time.
Yeah.
I just didn't know what you thought of him in this movie as a figure in that whole movement, or the idea of this anti-establishment
setup. I think he just he has a moment where he sees the way he is perceived by people, and he sees a really positive reaction. And you know, it's seemingly in a lot of his life, the average person has not been particularly positive towards him. So he plays into it. It's just sort of a reflex. And I agree with you. I think if that is the perception of this film, and certainly the Attica scene is the most famous moment in this film. It's the only moment that's been referenced on The League, you know. Yes, I agree. I think it's overblown. I think it's as simple as... the thing, part of the interesting thing, or one of the most interesting things about Sonny, is that he is an outcast and talks about it, and is a member of an underrepresented group, especially in the 70s. And I think it's just sort of, it's more to add to the personal element of Sonny that he's just accepted by a group of people, and he loves that because that doesn't happen to him, you know?
Right. And part of it for me, I think, is that he's such a different guy out front when he's throwing money around and being such a rock star as compared to when he is inside. Like, he's so calm, and he's so concerned about everyone's feelings. And I know, like, we kind of made jokes about how it makes him kind of a bumbling bank robber, but it's also makes him a good person. And I heard Frank Pearson, the writer of this movie, saying that the real Sonny, who is in jail after this movie, spoiler alert, wouldn't want to do interviews with him because he didn't think he'd get enough money out of it. And Pearson had to interview other people from Sonny's life. And he said he found a key to this character once he noticed that everyone would always say things about Sonny, telling them, oh, I'll take care of you. Like, I've got you. Like, I understand, but it's going to be okay because, you know, I'm here. I'm going to do this for you. Mm-hmm. And there's that part of this character that just doesn't want to hurt anyone. And when the guard gets asthma, like, Sonny says, I'm dying here. Like, these other people's problems, like, become so personal to him. And so that's why rewatching this movie, I still am struck by the fact that there isn't that folk hero moment. There isn't that speech. There isn't that thing other than Gattaca that he says that aligns him with the general public and not the oppressive government, the man society, you know?
Yeah, for sure. He doesn't have his Fonda at the end of Grapes of Wrath speech.
No, exactly.
Which is good. It's certainly helpful for the movie.
I know it's something that you like. But I think that he, even just pursuing these motivations, I think, in doing so, I mean, I think it's this very powerful voice for the gay rights movement. Like, we talked about that for a little bit. I don't think anyone thinks this movie is, you know, like a gay movie, you know, whatever that means. But I mean, people put things in categories like that. Like, it's for, you know, this A-list star to be where he was after The Godfather, to take this role as not just a gay guy, but a gay guy committing crimes in order to pay for a sex change for his wife / current boyfriend. It's pretty incredible. And the fact that that's, like, I think the fifth on the list of things people would ever even list about this movie, is really, really insanely progressive.
No, this movie is bafflingly progressive. It's bananas that this movie was made in 1975. Like, it's so... And, like, there's nothing that really, like, there are homophobic slurs in the movie from people that don't agree with Sonny's orientation. But it's, I don't know, like, there didn't really seem to be a note of Sonny and Leon's relationship, you know, other than the abusive aspects. But that really felt like something that wouldn't be a part of a, you know, like a modern movie, you know, like all of the writing for those characters, I felt was, none of it really stood out in the way that most movies that are 40 years old that tackle quote unquote issues are, you know, like it's, I found it really, really amazing.
And I mean that they're not stereotypically gay to the point that you don't know one of them is gay for a long time, or bisexual, however you want to phrase it. You know, that's something that comes in pretty late in the movie, and it's this, a character that we've already established the way that we feel about him by this point, and then to learn this, you know, it's, and just that at that time that homosexuality is so tangential to the plot of this movie, like it's his personal relationship. I mean, it's his motivation. It's incredibly crucial to this movie being kicked off and the action of it actually taking place. But his relationship is important, but is the fact that it's a homosexual relationship, it has nothing to do with, like, not nothing, because it obviously gets mentioned and, you know, the public opinion changes on him a little bit from the people crowded outside. But it is just remarkably sidelined given the time. Like, this would be remarkably sidelined if it came out this way now. But the fact that it was treated with, you know, treated that way then, I think is remarkable.
Well, yeah. And just imagine, like, people that love The Godfather going to see this, because this movie was released a year after The Godfather 2, going to see this movie, and then that sort of turn where
he just looks like a badass with guns robbing a bank.
And Al Pacino, your hero, your badass hero from The Godfather, Godfather Part 2, where he's especially badass. And presumably there are homophobic super fans of Al Pacino that are like, yeah, I'm gonna go see this movie where Al Pacino robs a bank. And just that turn, and I'd be so curious to, like, see this movie in 5 packed theaters over like across America in 1975. Like, I feel like that would have been just a interesting social experiment.
And I think Pacino expressed some apprehension about taking the role because it was a gay character and mm-hmm. because of, you know, how loaded that would have been, especially at the time. And I think they decided what their goal would have to be is to make that telephone scene so good and so universal and that you couldn't help but feel for it and, mm-hmm. you know, just kind of forget any prejudice or bias you have at that point because you see them as just two human beings who have these feelings for each other that hopefully everyone can relate to. And I think in some of the original scripts, there's a lot more explicit dialogue about, mm-hmm. you know, actual homosexual sex and things like that. And it just became clear that, you know, these are people who are worried they're never going to see each other again. This one's admitting that he's attempted suicide and he's going back to a mental institution. And this one has hostages and is surrounded by police and is trying to escape the country. These things are so far from their mind at this point, even if that's the thing that heterosexual people think about homosexual when they think about them. It's so irrelevant to the human part of the story that it became quite clear very early that there's just no reason for it in the script. And that's why I think that has a lot to do with why that phone call plays off with as much impact as it does.
Yeah, I agree. And I love that scene. We talked about, I talked and you listened about about Lumet really picking his spots for making camera movements and stuff. But his best filmmaking comes in that scene. And I think it's so, so interesting. And like, cause that, I think that scene, both including both phone calls to both Leon and his female wife, Angie. The way that the conversation with Leon starts off is so, so interesting because the way Pacino is framed close up in darkness, you know, his end of the call, it's just him. The whole screen is his face and the camera never moves on Pacino for the whole duration of both conversations. It is a static shot. When we start with Leon, he's in the barbershop. There's been space cleared for him to have this phone call. But he's still kind of obscured in the angle that we get of him. He's sort of like hiding behind, not hiding behind something, but the way that the camera is positioned from far away. And he's probably only taking up like 10% of the frame, but it sort of gives this view of him being obscured. And the camera slowly comes closer towards Leon over the course of their conversation. And eventually the two of them end up in sort of a graphic match. When you're cutting between the two shots, they're very similar. And it's very the way you would shoot a normal phone conversation, right? You got Pacino on the right side of the screen looking slightly left with his eye line and then vice versa for Leon. And it turns into this traditional conversation. But what makes that interesting is when we find out how abusive the relationship is, we get the camera movement really accentuates that because what Sonny is trying to do at the beginning of the conversation is get Leon to talk to him, to listen to him again. And then what ends up as the camera gets closer and they get closer together graphically on the frame, Sonny eventually gets angry again. And what happens is Leon hypothetically would go back to to hiding from Sonny, which is what he's doing in the frame, intentional or not, but the way the camera positions it, he would be hiding from Sonny, right? And it's just sort of this endless cycle of an abusive relationship. And I had never seen something like that done before. And it's not like the camera goes away from Leon at the end and we end up back where we are or at the beginning, but it is this slow drawing in. It's exactly the way like you think somebody would go back to an abusive partner. It's this person has abused me. I'm frightened of them. Oh, but now they're talking me into going back to them. Oh, and then this cycle of rage continues. And it's so, so subtle throughout the movie and so incredible, you know, like filmmaking wise. It's just amazing.
Just that idea of like, oh, you're out, you're in the clear, and then something pulls you back in. And that's, I mean, that characteristic of Sonny is something that slowly gets revealed out of the movie too. Like we kind of first see him, robbing a bank, obviously you think certain things. And then we get some of those softer things, you know, just the way he does care about people, the way he doesn't want to have any violence. And then he just seems like a normal guy. And then it's these conversations with Leon and things like that, that you don't have, whether he's a Vietnam vet or a bank robber or all these other things that have come up, this is you actually getting to know who he is and not just jobs he's had or positions he's been backed into in his life or, you know, things you can make excuses about. This is just stripping away all these things and now we're getting to who he is. And it's just an interesting structure because it's him surrounded by strangers and Sal his whole life. And then we kind of, not his whole life, the whole movie. And then we get, you know, we get Leon, we get his wife, we get his mother, we get these people who he seems closer and closer to. And, you know, his whole character gets fleshed out of how he's been his whole life and in the years and months preceding this bank robbery, which is, you know, when we met him. Mm-hmm. And then by the end, it seems like we have a fully realized character, and you know, then Sal gets shot in the head.
Well, and I think to touch on the second phone call in that same scene where Sonny calls Angie, it's an even more aggressive conversation quickly, and it just ends up with Sonny just angrily hanging up the phone, and I think that's meant to suggest that. Eventually that's the type of conversation Leon and Sonny would be having. Like this relationship would get even harder for Sonny to get Leon back to him emotionally. And, just all, everything would always get worse in this relationship. And I think that's an interesting suggestion. Yeah. Great scene. And, touching on what we've talked about with Lumet and the way he makes films, I found the way he made that scene really interesting because got Pacino to do everything in one take. But film magazines could only go, excuse me, for about 11 minutes. And it's about a 15 minute long scene. So the way that they shot that scene was with two cameras next to each other. And as the first magazine on camera one was running out, they would fire up the second camera, identical lenses, everything. So it would just basically be, a continuation and Pacino could just keep going. And, Lumet knew that he wanted Pacino to have full concentration, so he cleared the set and even blacked out everything around Pacino so that he can't even see the cameras. They're kind of like behind a wall. But, you know, of course, there's room for the lens to shoot him, but he was just physically alone in this black space. And after they finished the first take, Lumet was like, oh, that was great, but like we need to do another one. And Al Pacino looked at him like, are you fucking kidding me? Because this is very emotional thing, and everything we know about the way Al Pacino treats roles, it's like he was coming in hot, you know, like he was coming in ready to emotionally destroy himself. And Lumet's like, trust me, we have to do it again. And so what they did was kept rolling on camera two and quickly reloaded camera one, which used to be the beginning of the scene. So they just kept going on camera two, and as he was getting to the midpoint of the scene, they roll on camera one and they do it in second take. And that's the one that's in the movie. And Lumet describes this as when Pacino finished the speech, he just kind of like looked around like he had no idea what was going on and just collapsed in tears. Like, and I think that is telling because one, if you haven't been able to tell from the tone of my voice throughout this podcast, I think Pacino's amazing in this movie. I think Pacino's amazing, full stop. But at the end of this scene is where Sonny is just broken, you know? We don't even get a glimpse of hope from him for the rest of the movie.
No, and he just looks so exhausted and so shattered the whole time. And that story you told is a good example of, like, one of him being very good and very accommodating of actors, and by him I mean Lumet, you know, having those cameras ready, not having making him wait to do all this stuff to shoot another one, but then also making him do another one right after that. And like, it is in service of a good shot and everything, but it's you know, him kind of doing both things, like him being very efficient, but him also getting the best out of his performers.
Yeah, exactly. He was smart enough to know that he was making a movie in 1975 with Al Pacino and that was his biggest weapon. So, yeah. quickly.
Should we talk about Inside Man for a bit?
Yeah, I think we should.
Okay.
Yeah. I really like Inside Man a lot.
Okay.
Yeah. You?
Yeah, it's got some things that I love so much, and then like even just the ending of this movie, I think, can sum up how I feel about all of it. The escape method is so cool, and the ending still feels really unsatisfying to me. Mm-hmm. That's how I feel about a lot of this movie. Like, a lot of the technical stuff about how to rob a bank and how to, you know, deal with someone robbing a bank, like just how they set up a perimeter and cordon off an area, I think is interesting to me. And then, you know, almost on the same token, there's a lot of very interesting filmmaking stuff done in this. But it's missing something. Like, it's emotionally, I don't find it very impactful at all. I find the ending to be disappointing. And then, I don't know, I watched Dog Day Afternoon after this, after seeing, well, I'd seen both before, but watched them again, and then went on a really long binge thinking and researching Dog Day Afternoon and how much it has to say. And I just don't think this movie has much to say.
I think... Yes. Sir, I mean, we're comparing it to Dog Day Afternoon, so
yeah, exactly.
It was never going to win. but I think this movie does get a lot of interesting things across. One of the things I found really interesting watching it again was the fact that the movie's all about listening, and I found that really interesting. Like, the importance of listening is, it's just, like, it's the most important thing in the movie. And I found that really interesting that in an action movie, all they want you to do is just sit and listen to what you're actually being told. I mean, we get at the very beginning, the opening scene, we get Dalton, his name is Dalton Russell, and he's sitting...
He's in a prison cell, right?
Or, okay, well, the first time you saw this movie, were you fooled for a second by this?
I remember thinking it didn't look like a jail.
Well, okay. Yeah, and there is
but
that... Then,
but you, I think you forget about the beginning pretty quickly on your first time watching it.
Man, I remember the first time watching this movie and saying to the person I saw it with in that opening scene, I was like, oh, he's living inside the bank. Like, the title is the title is so not subtle. And I think that's one of the worst parts of the movie is the fact that it's so obvious that Dalton is just living in the bank. But anyway, what he does is explain what he's going to do throughout the movie. He, whenever he's asked how are you going to get out of this, he tells them what he's going to do. The reason they're able to stay ahead of Frasier and the rest of the cops is because they are listening in. They bugged Vikram or whatever the thing that Vikram has around his neck when he comes out is released as a hostage. That is just in the police van the whole time. And that's a big part of how Dalton and company can stay ahead of people. And people frequently in this movie keep talking about nobody listening to them. The security guard at the end, when all the hostages are released and the police are shooting them with rubber bullets for one, and then basically lining them up and putting them on buses in their jumpsuits. And the security guard says, I work at the bank. Everybody's saying listen, but nobody's listening. And I think this movie is all about kind of jumping to conclusions and jumping to conclusions about the way people look and jumping to conclusions about what you expect a person to do. Like, you wouldn't expect a bank robber to tell you how they're going to exit the bank successfully, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's why the interview scenes are really interesting in this movie, because we see the different ways that Frasier and I forget what Chiwetel Ejiofor's character's name is, but the way they interrogate people and, you know, they are much less serious with Miriam. You know, and the old Jewish man who actually ends up being one of the bank robbers, you know, or yeah, certainly in on it. And they interrogate her or them differently than the way they interrogate the Armenian guy. And I think that's really interesting. And there's that moment in the interview with the woman that's talking on her phone at the beginning of the movie where Chiwetel Ejiofor and Frasier just are checking her out, and she's just like stops them and just like listen to me, you know. She doesn't say physically listen to me, but But it's really interesting. And when Frasier actually does start listening to Dalton, he's saying, you know, it's when he gets that note, follow the ring. And you learn some interesting things when you listen, is basically what this movie is trying to tell you. And I think that's really cool. I think it's a very good movie and it's very interesting.
Yeah, the interview scenes and just the idea of those interviews having to be performed is like one of my favorite things about this movie, because the idea of having, you know, what, 30 suspects? I don't know if we ever get a number.
Yeah.
But basically 30 suspects and no evidence, just trying to go off purely off interviewing someone. The idea of being able to interview someone, like to have nothing else about someone and just ask them enough questions to see if they could admit that they did it. That's interesting to me. And like this is a more thought out bank robbery than we got in Dog Day Afternoon.
Yeah. Well, that's a big difference is that Dog Day Afternoon is from the robber's perspective, mostly, almost entirely. Sorry. And Inside Man is mostly from the, police point of view. And, you know, you like, we certainly get, like I said, the opening scene is Dalton Russell talking directly to us. But you know, there's certainly more Frasier than Russell. Right. So, but that is kind of, and, in Dog Day Afternoon, the robber is never in control. In Inside Man, the robber is totally in control all the time.
Yeah. And what I was going to say, but like the thing, one of the brilliant things about this plan that I love the most is, all the things they've done to prepare for those interviews, because they know that that's going to be the way that if they get caught, probably how they get caught is slipping up in those interviews or just being identified too quickly. So I love how they kind of pull each other out of rooms and mm-hmm. kind of rotate the population and then have one fake getting their ass kicked or like starting little uprising.
Yeah. Ziggy yeah. going full Ziggy. You mean?
Ziggy going full Ziggy. Yeah. But I mean, that's just, one of the kind of negative forms of listening, you know, like when you've been fooled and it's just the way that Frasier wastes all this time trying to figure out this Albanian
yeah.
speech, you know, Russell's aware that they're listening. And, you know, as you said, this movie is all about listening. Russell knows that they're going to listen to them and he gives them something that's going to just drain a lot of their time while they listen. And, you know, get a bug into the way that bug was placed on them, mm-hmm. hoping they wouldn't realize he sends one back and actually does get it kind of under the radar, which is very, very good.
Yeah, for sure. And I like that scene again, further accentuating the whole listening point is that, you know, when they say, do you know what language is it? Like, does anybody out here know what language it is? Oh, it's Albanian. It's 100% Albanian. Okay, so what's he saying? He's like, I don't know. I don't speak Albanian. Like, they just jump to the conclusion that since he knows it's Albanian, he speaks Albanian, which isn't highly illogical, but, you know, it's an assumption that they have made that is incorrect, you know?
Yeah, and you mentioned the idea of mistaking hostages as criminals. I mean, we get one instance of that in Dog Day Afternoon when they send out the guard of Thasma, who we'll just say happens to be black and happens to be treated as a criminal instantly.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of one of the other things that people point to in Dog Day Afternoon is showing that just the way that certain classes or the certain parts of the population at that time were treated just because of who they are.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What about the political motivations? I mean, we talked about...
Oh, just before we move on, we should talk about the scene where Vikram is released and not treated well by the cops.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're yelling, he's Arab, he's Arab. Or they say, oh, shit, he's an Arab, I think is the actual line. He's a Sikh. They take his turban and are in no rush to get it back to him, even though it's very obviously very important to his religion. And I found that a very interesting scene. And there are all kinds of dashes of this type of thing throughout this movie that I don't think were in the initial script, because they really are very Spike Lee type moments. Just in general, the diversity of Inside Man is not how the average 2005, I believe it came out, Hollywood film looked, you know? 2006? Okay. Yeah, actually, yeah, it was. Yeah. That's not the way Hollywood filmmaking looked in 2006, you know?
Oh,
it's
yeah.
Just like, it's such a diverse cast.
Yeah, and the his turban gets a much more thorough looking over than the sign he brought out around his neck, which contained the recording device that, as you said, kind of did in this whole operation of trying to stop the bank robbers in time.
Yeah, and it's also just a very post 9/11 movie.
Yeah, a post 9/11 New York movie. Which
yeah,
is,
yeah, for sure.
As post 9/11 as things get, it's post 9/11 New York.
Yeah.
We just kind of talked about a lot of the social meanings in Dog Day Afternoon, and you know how maybe a lot of the credit it gets for their kind of standing up as a very 70s movie in that sense. What do you, and I mean, we talked about the 9/11 post 9/11 stuff. What about the Nazi kind of subplot we have in Inside Man?
I think that's the weakest part of this movie in general. I think the thing that it's meant to do is be just sort of a common good versus greed, right? And you know, like what wins out in your head, like and I think this movie spends spends some time trying to show us the way the old world was built and all the shots of architecture we get leading up to the bank in the opening sequence. And just a quick note between Dog Day Afternoon and Inside Man, very similar opening credit sequences. But we get a lot of shots of this old world architecture. And when we go to Madeline's office for the first time, Jodie Foster's character, we get the same thing. When we go to Case's office, which is Christopher Plummer's character, we get even more and
yeah, even older somehow.
Yeah, and all the transitions back to these scenes or these locations are prefaced by these shots of like old architecture, and what that's saying is that this is how this world was built, and what it's saying is that you know, Case had an option to be good, to try and protect the family that he knew that was Jewish during the Holocaust, or to follow his greed. And what he did was follow his greed, right? And I think Dalton's got the line at some point in the movie. I don't totally remember when, but he says there's a big difference between being stuck in a tiny cell and being imprisoned. And Case has that line later on. He's been trying to make up for his mistakes his entire life. And despite the fact that Dalton has been in this self-imposed or self-constructed cell for a week, it's nothing compared to what Case has put himself through and what he has put other people through, you know.
Yeah.
In the past, you know, and that is certainly the weakest part of the movie. I kind of like the tie-in at the end with the diamond, where Dalton just sort of throws Fraser one last question, like, what are you gonna do, by putting the diamond in Fraser's pocket as he's exiting the bank, where it's sort of like, are you going to follow what you know is right, or are you just going to go with what is best for you? You know?
Yeah.
And I think that's really interesting. I like that.
Go ahead.
But in general, I think that's much less interesting than the listening aspect of the film and the sort of the way people are treated based on their appearance.
Right. What do you make of the presence of an action sequence in Inside Man and the lack of one in Dog Day Afternoon? An action sequence that's really unnecessary and doesn't really do much, right?
It's a hypothetical action sequence, right?
Right, yeah, that's what I like. It's really inconsequential. And even when they do kind of get them, I mean, that's our when they do arrest everybody in the jumpsuits, which is a great idea, by the way.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Is
there aren't a lot of bad ideas in Dalton Russell's plan, yeah?
No, not really.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, even that is kind of pretty flashy, and you know, I've heard Spike kind of say this part, that hypothetical action scene and just getting them all together at the end, you know, he felt like it was time to inject some action into it.
Yeah, it's very modern. It's like certainly makes it a more modern movie. I don't think it hurts the movie. I don't think it helps the movie. I think it's just basically a wash, you know. And okay. I mean, Spike Lee is operating at a very high level of a filmmaker at this point in this film. And I mean, a 3-minute interlude where we get to watch Spike Lee shoot an action scene. Not terrible, you know? So. And we get what is probably a little Cagney reference when he's following, when he's getting shot up in the safe.
Yeah. Are you excited about Inside Man 2?
No, it's never going to happen.
Oh, it actually is not going to happen. No. What about Dog Day Night?
Three Dog Day Night?
Dog Day Evening? I don't know.
Yeah, that's probably not going to happen either. Am I allowed to talk a little bit more about Inside Man? Is that allowed?
Of course.
Okay. Well, I like Spike Lee more than you do. I think Spike Lee is a very good director, and I think even when he makes bad movies, which I will fully admit, I've seen way more of Spike Lee's movies than I thought I had, and the reason I don't really think about them very much is because they're not good, but like I just watched Summer of Sam about a week ago, and it wasn't good. 20 minutes of it was really interesting, but that 20 minutes was worth my 140 minutes total that I put into it, and yeah. I think that's something that... that I think we can tie into Sidney Lumet's career is that Spike Lee kind of has a more diverse career than people give him credit for. A lot of his decisions have been poor. I watched Old Boy, and I mean, that really felt like a movie that was re-edited by a studio, but I don't think it would have been a good movie had Spike had full control. But he's not afraid to try things, and I think that's kind of the... It's totally different from Lumet, like we said, where Lumet is sure that something will serve the story, every decision he makes, whereas Spike will kind of throw something out there and see if it works. And I think that is why when he does make a good film, it's really, really wonderful to watch, like Inside Man, where everything sort of comes together, and why even when he's making a terrible film, it's really interesting to watch still, because no people don't make movies that look like Spike Lee movies, except for the scenes of Martin Scorsese movies that are very clearly influencing Spike. I feel like he would make the list. Like, I would love it if somebody would just give Spike Lee $20 million every year to direct a movie. And that's, I mean, that is a long list of people, but I feel like culture in general would be better off for somebody like Spike Lee having money to work with. And I think you see it in Inside Man. You see this really, this genre movie that is really elevated by the perspective that I think we can agree is Spike's, the way minorities are depicted in the film, the fact that minorities are in the film,
at that dinner or in the diner scene you were discussing, that I bet you can get a cab though, yeah. Line that could be in every Spike.
Yeah. And I also in general really like Denzel in this movie. I think he's really good. And I think he fits right in with what he's supposed to do in the movie. I think Clive Owen's amazing. In general, like, this is a really well-acted movie. I can't think of a weak link. And even going back to Spike Lee's talent as a stylist, the way that this film is shot I found really interesting, because it really represents who's in control in the film. And basically, the cops are almost always shot handheld, except for when they meet up with Clive Owen and the other bank robbers, and they sort of end up on Owen's turf. And then when we're in Owen's turf, everything's shot steady cam or on tripods. It's all very controlled. And we get that with Madeline too. Her world is very controlled. There's this really big crane shot surveying the whole scene about midway through the movie. And I was like, oh, that's weird. We're seeing things from the police perspective, and this is sort of signifying that things are in control. And where does the crane shot end up? It ends up focused on Madeline in the diner, just sitting and hanging out and waiting for Fraser to come talk to her. And I thought that was really interesting. And, you know, when the pizzas are brought in, we get a meeting of the robbers and the cops, but the cops are kind of in control because they have the pizza, from Sal's, which is a really nice touch. And the cops are kind of the ones running that scene. But when we get Fraser and Dalton meeting for the first time, that scene is shot on Steadicam because Dalton has something that Denzel wants, or that Fraser wants, and the opposite is true in the pizza scene. And one of my favorite scenes in the movie is right after that diner scene where Fraser and Madeline White are talking. They're talking in front of that Never Forget mural. And that conversation is handheld because what happens is Frasier introduces introduces Madeline to Dalton, right? And so from both sides of both Frasier and Madeline are shot in handheld, and Clive Owen still shot in Steadicam. And the second that Clive Owen invites Jofo into the bank, we snap to a wide shot that is on tripod in front, like it's a nice wide shot in front of that mural, and the camera's not moving at all because Jodie Foster is back in control, and it's just such a wonderful little moment, and that those control perspectives are all throughout this movie. It's really great, and it's just that type of like really high class filmmaking that Spike Lee really can bring to a genre movie that I really enjoy.
I saw someone describing it in a critic's review said it's definitely a Spike Lee movie, but it's not a Spike Lee joint. Mm-hmm. And his point was that, you know, as you said, it is a genre movie. It's not the type of movie everyone's going to associate with Spike Lee, but he still brings, you know, he still brings his camera, like he still brings that eye for visual. He still
the Spike Lee dolly shot.
Yeah, exactly. He still injects all those those things you said about including certain characters and a certain type of humor, but also just his abilities behind the camera. You know, it still shows up in the visuals of this movie, but it's not, you know, it's not the, you know, quintessential Spike Lee vibe, but it's still a showcase of his talents as a talented filmmaker. And as you said, he's at the top of his game here. And, you know, he's I did mention that the sequel to this, which won't happen, but you know, he said like this is my movie that made the most money and I can't even get a sequel made.
Yeah,
making sequels, this movie made money and I still can't get a sequel to this, so yeah. No, it's never gonna happen.
I don't know. And I mean, I feel like it's always weird to me when I'm watching a movie that is 9 years old and thinking, man, this would never get made now. You know, like that's
what is it about now that it, like, what is it about the movie that wouldn't get made now?
Well, I think like this is the question that would be asked in the pitch meeting, although pitch meetings seem to happen less and less nowadays. But it would be, how do we sell this movie? And like, where's the big bang up moment? Where's the property that we're building on? And that's the most upsetting thing about Inside Man.
And that, like, and I think the fact that, and I know Clive Owen did have struggle. Well, I've read that Clive Owen struggled with this, but just the idea of not having your face on the screen so often. Like, you would think for a leading man, they would want an attractive looking person with a nice face, and for that face to be on screen as much as possible. But they got that with Denzel, but not Clive Owen this time around, because, like, 98% of the cast of this movie, he wears a mask the entire time almost.
Well, I mean, we all wear masks. But yeah, thank you for listening to the MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check back next week where we'll be talking about whatever we're talking about next week. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.